I'm Tom Downing.
I'm Adam DiCarlo.
And welcome to Before the Break, a podcast for actors
by actors.
Brought to you by Working Actor Pro.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Before the Break. I'm once again joined by special guest host Julian Gavilanes. This week, we are thrilled to meet our guest. He really needs no introduction, but I'm going to do one anyway. You've seen him in recurring roles on such shows as Fringe, Gotham, The Tick, Mindhunter, and The Good Wife, just to name a few, and he's currently a series regular on The Gilded Age. His Broadway credits include The Who's Tommy, Titanic, Evita, Assassins, Sweeney Todd, and Fun Home. Please welcome to the show the incredibly talented two-time Tony Award winner, Michael Cerveris. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you guys?
Good. We are, you know, surviving pushing a strike, through. I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pushing through these strange times indeed.
Yeah.
So Michael, as we always do, we start at the beginning. You are from Bethesda, Maryland, correct?
I was born there. My dad was in the Navy at the time, and he was stationed in DC, so I was born in the Naval Hospital there. But we only lived there for a couple years, and then moved. So mostly I grew up in West Virginia, in Huntington, West Virginia.
Okay.
I technically was born in Maryland, but I have really no memories of it.
Gotcha. What was your childhood like in terms of the arts? Was it something that you were exposed to at a young age? Did that come a little bit later in life?
No, it came almost immediately because my dad, while he was in the Navy, he was in the Navy band.
Oh, nice.
And did his service there. So I grew up, my grandfather came over from Italy, from a small town sort of near Naples. And he was a flautist, and he was the first chair flautist in the Pittsburgh Symphony. And he fixed instruments for a living in the Pittsburgh County schools system. So there were arts in the family going way back. And my father was a Juilliard-trained pianist and an educator and taught in universities. My mom and he met at Juilliard. She was a modern dance student studying with Martha Graham. So... Whoa.
Oh,
so I was surrounded by the arts from birth, essentially.
That's amazing.
And not surprisingly, my sister ended up going into dance and was a ballerina with New York City Ballet and was one of the last three ballerinas that George Balanchine brought into the company. And my brother is also an actor. He lives in New York as well, Todd. So all three of us, you know, we grew up surrounded by the arts. I remember falling asleep as a kid to the sound of my father practicing piano downstairs. And he would, in addition to teaching at the university and stuff, he always loved musical theater as well. So he became the musical director for some university productions at Marshall University in Huntington, where he was teaching. And also in community theater, he got very involved in community theater and summer stock. So my earliest experiences were all sort of family related. My first time on stage was in a production of the Caucasian Chalk Circle in a Brecht play. I was one of the little prince's friends.
You know, just something light.
You know, looking back, I think I could see where the direction of my career was set pretty early on.
Yeah.
Wow. Even though it was like in the family line of art, was was it still like, did your parents encourage it for you, or was it kind of like, don't, yeah, I don't want you to get into this world? It's,
well, it's awful. It's interesting because they had
some are very much like that.
Yeah,
they're like, I'm an actor. My kid will never be an actor.
Exactly. Exactly. I think I would sort of feel like that, you know. And I think, you know, both of them had seen and had been exposed to people, especially in classical music and in dance, you know, that the actor's life is tough enough. You know, classical musicians have an even tougher road, I think, in some ways. So they both had a healthy regard for the sacrifices and the precariousness of that kind of career. And I think I inherited some of that from them. And so I did a lot of theater and stuff, and I enjoyed it. And I was, you know, I was a little kid in a lot of productions, and the whole family would sort of decamp to Eastern Kentucky to the Jenny Wiley Summer Music Theater, or the Jenny Wiley Summer Music Theater. And spend the summer there doing summer stock and stuff. It took me a long time to decide that that's what I was going to do. It was a thing that I did, like, you know, and I played Little League and I, you know, did midget league basketball.
It was one of an extracurricular activity.
Yeah. And it was that I put a lot of time and energy into, but still it wasn't like, I know I want to be an actor and this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And that was kind of made clear when I was applying to colleges and stuff. And I decided, I applied to like 7 different schools because you didn't have to, it wasn't all that expensive to apply to different schools. And my, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but essentially even through college, I studied other things in addition to acting and to theater because I wasn't certain that I was going to try to pursue this as a career. And I sort of thought, I'll see if there's something else that I'm equally
keep your options open.
In. Totally. And have a well-rounded education, which was important to my parents and to me. And, you know, see what comes of that 4 years, and then, you know, then make up your mind.
Was that because you weren't fully sold on your ability to do it, or because you like had different ideas of how like your parents were doing it, or what was that decision being made from?
I think it was a bit of both of those things. I think I wasn't at all certain that, you know, I had whatever it was that it took to have a career.
Delusion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, disregard for your own health and well-being.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about that. And I wasn't sure that, I don't think I was sure that it would satisfy and fulfill everything that I was interested in. And I think it was partly because I had a kind of limited and not entirely well-informed understanding of what the profession was and what the opportunities were.
It is a bit of a wild, wild west, and it's different for everybody. I love that you had your head on your shoulders to even have these conversations with yourself, because I feel like so many times people are like, I want to be an actor. Look at all these people to aspire to, and I want to get to that. And you were like, meh.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love that, though, because usually people don't have the wherewithal to like have that conversation.
So I went away for my last 2 years of high school. I went to public school up until my last 2 years of high school, where I ended up going to a school in New Hampshire called the Phillips Exeter Academy. That's a really super high level functioning private school, boarding school, co-ed, fortunately. But and that I ended up in, it's like a long story probably would take the whole rest of the podcast to tell. But it wasn't because I was wanting to get out of West Virginia. You know, I was super happy growing up there. I really loved being a kid in West Virginia and had all the, you know, typical, you know, movie of the week kind of childhood there, and, you know, played sports and did theater and rode bikes in the evening. And, you know, it was a great place to grow up. And I think I had no plans to leave it. My parents weren't from there. They wanted our horizons to be a little further than the county line of Cabell County in West Virginia.
Right.
And so there was a guy came to my junior high to kind of, you know, pitch this school if anybody wanted to apply. And my friends and I, we were, you could stay the next class. The period ran out that they were had allotted for this guy to talk. They said, if you're interested in hearing the rest of the pitch, you can stay into the next period. And the next period was a class that a couple of friends and I didn't want to go to. So we said, yeah, sure, we want to stay. So, and it was a pretty impressive presentation. So we stuck around. And then afterwards, the teacher from that next class dragged us all to the vice principal's office and said, these boys aren't interested in that school. They just wanted to get out of my class, which of course was true, but which of course we denied. And, you know, said, no, actually, you know, we're very interested, and please, you know, send some materials to my home so we can, you know, explore it further. And so this stuff shows up, and my parents think that I'm showing interest in having a, you know, a more rigorous education. And so they really encouraged me to do it. And I just thought it was interesting because you had to write an essay. And
like, what have I gotten myself into?
I didn't really think that. I thought that. But in the beginning, it was just like, yeah, this will be fun. I'll never get into this place. We'll never be able to afford it. So
and it was something you were doing with your friends, too. Your friends were involved in doing it. Yeah, so it was just a thing totally. You guys were doing.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then one hurdle after another fell. And, you know, suddenly I was getting a letter saying you're accepted with all the financial aid that would make it possible for you to go. And now I have to like decide. And this is even including having driven up to the school for the final interview and driving back and seeing it and seeing their theater, which was amazing. And it's an extremely well endowed school. Also so well endowed that their financial aid is separate from their admissions. So they accept you, and then they just figure out how to make it possible for you to go, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
So, but even after visiting, I was like, that was really, really cool. I'll never see it again, but I'm, you know, I'm so glad that we made this drive up to see this place. Mm-hmm. And, so then I get accepted, and now I have to actually think about, So I wasn't trying to like get out of West Virginia at all. I don't know what I thought I would do there for the rest of my life. You know, I don't know what job I thought I would have had. But I, at the time anyway, wasn't looking to get out. But as I thought about it, somehow, I don't know how I knew this, but even at that age, which would have been, I guess my sophomore year of high school.
It's like 15, 16-ish?
Yeah, probably. I guess I turned 16 in my first year at Exeter, I think. So, yeah, probably 15. I felt like I know that if I stay here, I think I'll be happy here in West Virginia. If I leave here, I don't know that I'll ever be content to be back here again. And then the third thing that I realized, and this was all like, I remember sitting at the kitchen table with my parents and talking about what I was going to do. And somehow I realized that I wasn't supposed to be content and stay here, that whatever it is that I was supposed to do, was supposed to be someplace else. And and I somehow instinctively knew that that was inviting discontent for the rest of my life, or, you know, unease at least. But I just felt like I'm supposed to want more. I'm supposed to aspire to more. So, you know, so I went and was miserable in the beginning. Every morning I asked myself, you know, can I get through today? And if I decide that I can get through today, I'll decide tomorrow if I want to stay. And I'll really let myself decide to leave tomorrow if I want to. But can I at least decide to get through the day? Yeah, I can get through today. And then the next day you do that again. And then after doing that for a little while, maybe you can say, okay, well, I can stay till Wednesday, you know.
Right.
And then on Wednesday, if I want to leave, I'll leave. And it was just, you know, it's essentially, I guess, a version of a 12-step program, where it's kind of just like you're just trying to deal with today, and you're not looking at a whole future that seems insurmountable. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, while you were there, did you ever have any sort of creative outlet? Did they have any sort of arts there for you to participate in that kind of kept you there, or was it just not that kind of place?
No, that's the second thing that happened. So that, you know, this first kind of way of looking at my daily experience in a just kind of just get through each day way managed to kind of level me out a little bit for a while. And then the auditions for the first play of the year came up, because they did have a really active arts department there.
Okay.
Theater department. And the theater department was run by a guy named B. Rodney Marriott, who was also the literary manager at Circle Rep at the time, a downtown off-Broadway theater here. But I walked into the theater and I was like, okay, this world, I know I'm not the most talented person here, but I know how this world works, at least, as opposed to the school around me. And I know what is expected of me, and I know what the rules are and the requirements. And so I auditioned. The first play was a comedy of errors, Shakespeare comedy of errors. And I got the small but crucial role of Angelo the gold merchant, who has, you know, all of three lines of text. But that was like, and I remember vividly standing on the stage for the audition in the, you know, this little pool of light, and everything else is, you know, darkness, and the teachers and people are in the audience. And I felt at home there for the first time physically of any place there. And that began my, you know, not just enduring, but finding a place in the school. And I think that was like a pivotal moment in my life when I realized that, because I, you know, we moved around a lot when I was little. College was the only school I attended first year to last year in the same place. Every place else, I either started in one place or finished in another, or vice versa. So the idea of home and where I belong has always been really fluid and uncertain. The one place that I always felt at home was on a stage. And, you know, and it's funny because I have friends who say that, but they're the kind of friends who are like, I knew at 5 years old that I wanted to be an actor. Mm. I never had that
you
certainty.
Didn't. Yeah.
No.
Because you've been doing it.
Yeah.
Prior to all of this stuff, it sounds like that, like, you were solidified in that once you got to this, like, this place.
Yeah. And I still, you know, I still continued to resist it as a determining thing that this is what I was going to do now that I had found this. Mm-hmm. You know, when I applied to colleges, like I was saying, I, first of all, the guidance counselor was like, because our teacher, Mr. Marriott, had gone to Yale. And he really encouraged me to apply to Yale undergrad. So I went into the guidance, to my, you know, college submissions meeting with the guidance counselor and said, he said, you know, where do you want to apply? And I said, well, Yale. And he was like, yeah, I mean, you can do that, but let's look at Boston College. Boston College might be a really good fit for you. They have a good theater program. And I was like, yeah, that's good, but I want to apply to Yale too. And he was like, you want to spend your money? Sure. So I ended up applying to several conservatories like Carnegie Mellon and NYU and a couple of those places. And then other places like Oberlin and Northwestern and Yale and Brown, where I would get a, you know, thorough liberal arts education. And also they had good theater programs, because I wasn't still at this point certain that that's what I wanted to pursue.
You still wanted like a well-rounded, but still in the path of drama.
And also, I knew enough to think, you know, theater. And also, another thing was, I wasn't expecting to go into musical theater if I did have a career as an actor. I had done a bunch of summer stock stuff, but my, you know, my sensibilities and my interests, like I enjoyed seeing musicals and it had had fun doing the summer stock stuff I had, but I didn't think that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do like straight dramatic acting and classical theater. And so I thought I don't need to, I don't want to go to a place where I'm just going to be surrounded by other people doing theater. I'm going to go to a place, if I'm going to play all kinds of people, I want to go to a school surrounded by all kinds of people. And I ended up at a place, Yale, that sort of had that philosophy too. It wasn't even a department at Yale at the time. I think that's probably changed now. But they didn't think of theater as a sufficiently academic discipline. So my degree is in the humanities with an emphasis in theater studies. And their philosophy was, it's not like being a classical musician or you know, ballet dancer, where you have to train from age 5 in the technique stuff, that acting was something that you could acquire the technical skills you need later. And, you know, you should just be a well-informed, critical thinking person first, which I agree with. I mean, you know, obviously in musical theater, if you're, you know, a dancer and singer, having some technical background prior is going to be important, but I didn't think that's what I was going to be. So it wasn't so important to me. So in the end, I got into all the places I'd applied and was really enjoyed that meeting with my guidance counselor.
Yeah.
And then again, had to decide like where I wanted to go. And that's when all these decisions about what kind of place and what kind of education I wanted came out. And I decided on Yale. I really thought I was going to go to Brown, because Brown's program was, may still be like this, but like they had no course requirements. So you could take like basket weaving 20 times and graduate, you know.
Nice.
I don't know if that's still the case, but.
I have to imagine it's not. I have to imagine it's not.
But I got like such a great, cool, creative vibe from the place when I visited, as opposed to Yale, that just looked like, you know, 4 years of being chained to a gray stone building and, you know, throwing scraps of food occasionally.
Right.
But in the end, I kind of decided, well, if I don't like it, I can transfer from Yale probably most anywhere. Right. And I'm not sure that I could transfer to Yale from someplace else if I didn't like that. So and also there's a certain amount of, you know, masochism, I think, involved. It was just like, yeah, I'll put myself through what seems like the hardest thing first. And it turned out to be the perfect place for me, because they, you know, they had a real emphasis on a full education. And, but because they didn't intend to teach you any technical stuff as an undergraduate. They figured if you really want to pursue this, then you go to grad school where you get all that technical training.
Yeah. But
because I wanted to do classical theater, I wanted to take voice, and there was no voice and speech program. So I studied the music school teachers, vocal teachers would teach undergraduates some. So I studied with a guy named Blake Stern, who was a German Lieder specialist and taught opera students. And he said, but he took a certain number of undergraduates, and he said, I know you don't want to be an opera singer, but I'm going to train you like you were going to be, and then you can do whatever you want to with it, but you'll have the, you know, the mechanics of your voice, you'll understand, which turned out to be the best possible training for me. So that, you know, some years later, when I get my first leading role in a musical professionally, which was Tommy, and I could not sing that score when we started. I added four or five notes to the top of my range just through the exercise of rehearsals, but I did it without ruining my voice because I had been trained how to use it.
Yeah.
In the first place,
you knew how the instrument worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew the mechanics of it. And then I think also when I was growing up, my dad wanted us all to learn an instrument for a year. We could pick the instrument and we only had to do it for a year. And then if we didn't want to pursue it after that, it was fine. But he felt like he owed it to his profession to at least try to pass it on to his kids. So we all started on piano, and I don't think any of us stuck with that. It's hard to learn from your dad at home, you know? And then I, in fourth grade, started violin, which I enjoyed and wished that I had kept up, but didn't. But it was fourth grade and it was not the cool instrument to be playing. And I switched to guitar and finished the, you know, second half of the year studying guitar, then put it away after the year was over for a couple years. And then one day picked it up again when I was like, probably like 13 and turning into a teenager, and kind of retaught myself by ear mostly. And so I mostly learned everything by ear and hadn't been trained musically to read really or anything, but I really developed my ear and would learn everything from just listening to the radio. So I had, I think I'd developed an ability to kind of break down what I was hearing stylistically and stuff. And so when I was doing Tommy, there were two other people in the cast, Jonathan DeKuchitz, who played Captain Walker, who had this really beautiful, effortless kind of tenor.
Don't you just hate those people? They sing and it's literally effortless and you're like...
Exactly. Yeah. Totally. And so I would like go to him and ask him questions or just listen to what he was doing and kind of figure out in my voice how my version of that was. And then there was another guy, Lee Morgan, who played the hawker, the harmonica hawker in Eyesight to the Blind. And he's one of those guys who you also hate, who sounds like he's going to lose his voice by the end of the bar. You know, he's like this throaty, ragged rock and roll voice, and he can sing like that for 7 hours at a stretch without ever having a problem. So between the two of them, I kind of like cobbled together, you know, listening and asking questions and stuff. And Joe Church, who was a music director, you know, was also helpful. And that was how I kind of developed my voice to sing Tommy. But because I'd had the initial mechanics from classical music, you know. And so at the end of college, then it was like, okay, well, now what do I do? My first thought was to go on to grad school. And I'd watched two full classes go through the 3-year program there while I was an undergrad. And I, you know, had made friends with some of the actors in the grad school. And so I thought, well, if I want to go anywhere, it would be Yale. But they and my teachers all encouraged me and all of us, if we wanted to do that, to go to New York for a year or so and see, you know, just where you think you are in relation to everybody else in New York. And then if you're not getting anywhere, then maybe apply and come back with an idea of like where the things are that you want to study. And that
that's a great idea. That's a great idea.
Instead of just
you
putting
finish off this, you've had this education, go out into the world, see if you sink or swim. And, you know, out of that kind of decide if you want to do your master's and go to grad school, have like a distinct path you want to go on out of, you know, the trials and tribulations of living in New York for a bit.
Yeah.
So did you do that after Yale? Did you come to New York?
I came straight to New York and, you know, immediately spent 98% of my time working in restaurants, trying to figure out how to eat, trying to figure out how anything worked. You know, in those days, it was buying Backstage every Thursday and pouring through those for auditions. And
How did your professional career really start to take shape and get legs once you moved to New York?
Slowly, I thought, but in hindsight, actually, it was pretty quick. I had met a girl in one of the summers doing summer theater in West Virginia, and she was a professional actress from New York who had come to town to do that job, and so we were dating through my senior year, and when I got out of Yale, I moved in with her in New York when I first got to town, and that was a huge help because she had been here for a couple years and at least knew things to tell me, like, you know, here's Backstage, here are the Ross reports where all the agents' addresses are listed. Here's where to go to get your headshots reproduced and then just walk them into places. And so I got a little kind of leg up on a lot of my friends because, you know, I think this is still, it's less true now, but still kind of true that a lot of training programs really don't prepare you for the nuts and bolts like what
Michael deal with. Michael.
Yeah.
That has been such a recurring theme on this show is they're like, they'll train you how to do the job, but then they don't tell you that a huge part of the job is trying to get the, you know what I mean? Like all that shit about making yourself essentially a business and how marketing works and how, you know, turning yourself into, you know, a product and getting yourself out there and how do auditions work? How does getting a representation, you know, a representation work? How to get your union cards? They don't tell you any of this shit. So you're out of school and then you're like, wait, how do I do this though? Because I have the talent that is refined, but then what do you do with the talent to like get this thing going? And no one tells you that. And so it's good that you had this person to kind of like, well, you know,
Here's nuts and bolts how you do things. And it was hard enough. It was hard enough then. Now I don't know how the fuck people do it, to be honest. Like I don't It was expensive and difficult then, but it was nothing like what it is now. I mean, I lived.
And now we have like social media and all that shit that I'm sure people, you know, have in the back of their heads as well. And it's just, it's a lot to get started, you know, and now, you know, having a website, a reel, all the websites that you have, like Actors Access and Backstage and all of that stuff. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And people don't realize
no,
all the things it takes to get that wheel turning so that an agent or a manager might even want to have a conversation with you, you know? Yeah. And at the end of the day, you really can't get into a lot of rooms without them. It's a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's important to think about like just being savvy after you get out of those institutions and trying to come out into the world and be like, okay, how do I like put my right foot forward here? What do I need to do? And it sounds like maybe you had your parents to kind of check in with and be like, did you guys go through something like this? Like, what's going on? I feel like a complete dipshit. I don't know what I'm doing. But were you able to like utilize them a little bit?
Not so much really, because their experience had been so, you know, the worlds of classical music dance were so different. and because they had decided from the beginning out of school not to pursue professional careers, right. They hadn't actually done that themselves. They'd, mm-hmm. you know, they'd figured out different skills in, you know, finding a job in academia and that kind of stuff. Their thing was very typical parents saying, why don't you just come home for a while and, you know, work and, you know, build up some money.
Come back to the nest, little bird.
Then go back, you know, with more money. And I kept having to find ways to explain to them that you know, that doesn't work. I have to be here for anything to happen, even though nothing is happening.
Right.
What do you think what was motivating that for you, though? Like, what was that? Like, because again, like I talk about delusion a lot. And it sounds like you had a pretty like logical, pragmatic approach to what you were doing as you were growing up. But at this point, here's where you start getting delusional and start thinking
I think I was pretty delusional and pretty oblivious. And I think what served me and what I worry about sometimes for young people now, you know, at that same watershed kind of moment. I didn't leave my training program, and I wasn't encouraged to think that I was anything special when I left. You know, yeah. I was taught that acting.
Thanks for coming. Adios.
Yeah. Well, it was just sort of the philosophy is you have to work your ass off, period. And there's no reward. You're not guaranteed or entitled to anything. Even though you've spent 4 years here studying and doing all this, you're still at the beginning of your journey. Yeah. And to even have a chance for anything to happen for you, you're going to have to work your ass off. But you aren't guaranteed that anything will come of it. But to even get the chance, you're going to have to work your ass off. And I worry that, you know, like you were saying, Adam, that when you leave a training program, you know, that your craft is honed and refined and you know that you have that. I didn't walk out of school feeling like, you know, I am a gem waiting to be discovered. I felt like, okay, I've been trained well to this point, but it's just the beginning of I have. And so my expectations are going to be shown to be unreasonable. Like I thought I went to New York and would get a job, and it was a real shock to realize, oh no, you spend all your time trying to get the chance to do the thing that you've been doing for 4 years and very little of your time actually doing it. But I didn't feel like I was entitled to it or, you know, deserved to just have it because I'd been to school for 4 years.
Right.
And I worry sometimes that, you know, that people are puffed up by training programs, and especially the ones who were the most successful in their school programs and then suddenly, you know, meet reality head on. I think that's a whole thing. Yeah. The kids who like weren't ever cast as the leads in things, I think in some ways are better suited for what lies ahead when they get to, you know, New York or Chicago or wherever.
Yeah.
So I looked at New York as my unpaid grad school. So I thought, I have no experience in camera. I went and put my headshot and resume in at every soap opera in New York and ended up eating hamburgers in the background of every teen disco on every soap opera in New York. And that's how I learned how people hit marks and what marks were and, you know, how to know which camera, what angle was happening. And some of the other extras were kind of doing the, you know, the extra socializing, extra, you know, dating pool kind of approach to being there. I was
being
just
on
there.
Set is a wonderful experience, an exercise in shut up and listen, and yeah. It will just be an entirely educational experience.
Right.
I mean, yeah. When I've always loved film, and a part of me has always wanted to be a filmmaker, and working on Gotham as Robin's stand-in for 5 years, I shut up, listened, and watched how The Thing gets made, and yeah. how directors and DPs and the camera, how they all talk to each other to make this thing. And it was like, wow, this is film school, and yeah. I'm getting paid. Like,
right.
And yeah. that gave me the confidence to make my first short film, and then learning from that, make my second short film. But I wouldn't yeah. have had that confidence of the language of filmmaking without that experience of being on set and being like, oh, I should just really enjoy this and listen and use this to my advantage. And it's a, you know, same with being, you know, an extra and background. It's like, watch how the thing gets made so that when it's your turn, it's not a totally foreign concept, you know?
Exactly. And you learn so much from watching different people, the yeah. way different people go through things. And you can sort of, if you're being smart and savvy and quiet about it, you can realize, oh, that person who seems to be like, you know, the big cheese here, I think the crew actually hates that person because, you know, because, yeah. because they, you know, act like they're doing it all alone and that nobody else is you right. know, there with them, as opposed to the person who, you know, will get extra help from the DP, you know, and will be told by the camera operator, you know, just keep your head down a little bit in this and it'll look, you know, you'll be glad later. And, you know, and right. then they go to the extra effort to make sure that that actor is taken care of and looks really good on camera, as opposed to the other people who are like, yeah, we got him. That's fine.
Right.
So yeah, it was that was where my, you know, camera training came from. And I would get like a part in a off Broadway show.
On Staten Island, actually, that yeah, off
exactly,
Broadway.
Exactly. Yeah. Prospect Park. and I wouldn't have enough lines to have any text sessions with the, I remember I was doing a Shakespeare play and I didn't have enough lines to have any meetings with the text person, but I would go to other actors' sessions and just sit in the back, you know, actors who had lines, and I just like listened to what they did. And I would go to the fight calls, even though I wasn't in any of the fights, just to watch how those rehearsals happened. So I really was a sponge for my first several years in New York. Yep. And
Was there a little bit of resentment ever when you would see actors that you were like, I can do that too. What are these guys doing it for? Like, why can't it be me? Did you ever have that? Or was it always just like, I'm just here to be a sponge. I'm just here to learn.
I'm sure that I had that frustration, you know, some, or when I would go see things when there were actors my age, you know, in them, and I'd be, and, or, you know, go see a movie or something. And I'd be like, you know, I could do that. But really, for the most part, my conscious thought was so much on, I've got work to do and I've got cool. shit to learn that yeah. I didn't have a lot of time to worry so much about what other people were doing. And I yeah. think somebody had said to me, and I try to always say this to, you know, students when I talk to them, you know, do not compare yourself to other people, because there will be people out of school who will take off like within months and you think they're set, and then a year or two later they've left the business because they had the impression that it was all going to be easy right away, and as right. soon as it starts to be hard, they're like, I'm out.
Yeah.
And then there are the other people who struggle away for years and it, you know, suddenly happens later. So that's a bad indicator of how you're doing, like how other people are doing. I mean, it's almost impossible to not be affected by it, but you know, the more you can, the better.
And so when did your career start taking traction and you started to book the, did you get, in these years, did you get representation at any point that sort of really helped you get into bigger rooms or?
Well, it was interesting. In the very beginning, when I would literally walk to different offices and slide your headshot through the mail slot, I would get called in sometimes for meetings with various agents, largely because I had Yale on my resume.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Whoa. But they, you know, what they were thinking of was the grad school, but they didn't necessarily realize the difference. And so I'd be, you know, so I'd get this appointment, I'd come in and they'd say, so, you know, you went to Yale. And I'd be like, yeah, undergraduate. And they're like, yeah, but so did we see you at the league auditions? I'm like, no, that's the grad school. Oh, right. But you were there with Rock Dutton and, I don't know, some, can't remember the other people who were there at that time, but, and I'd be like, well, I was there then, but they were in the grad school, but it didn't matter because I was in the office now. So, you know, I had that name on the piece of paper got me through the door. It didn't always get me an agent, but at least got me the meeting in a lot of cases. So that, you know, that was a help. And I was freelancing with a bunch of different people. Nobody wanted to sign me, but, you know, I would get sent out by different people. There was one agency that I had gone to, and they were like the most helpful also. I used to go into these meetings wearing a jacket and tie because, like, I had a meeting, you know, I had an interview.
Yale boy.
I brought my briefcase, and in that briefcase is my headshot and resume.
An Ivy League boy here.
But, you know, my hair was like down to my shoulders, but I had a jacket and tie on, you know.
Yeah.
But my answers were just like monosyllabic. Like, they would be, you grew up in West Virginia, Huntington, yes.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Exactly. And you went to Yale, undergraduate.
Why were you just afraid to like express yourself?
Yeah. I didn't have any experience, you know, in an interview, and once again, had not been taught in my training program interview skills. I mean, I would have been the same way if I was interviewing at Walmart, you know.
Right. Cue the flop sweat.
Exactly. And I finally, this one agent finally, at the end of our interview, said, we'll submit you for some stuff, you know, we'll freelance with you, but let me give you some pointers about these interviews. I know that it feels unnatural to you, and like you feel like, how are they going to know you in the 3 minutes of your interview? But you have to at least let them have the illusion that they do. So you have to like volunteer some information, and you have to, I know you think it's bullshit, and it is bullshit, but it's a bullshit that we all participate in, and you have to develop some skill in this or you're not going to get any place. And that was some of the most useful information that came out of any of these things. So I really appreciated that, and I thought, you know, these people showed more interest or care than anybody else had. So I really wanted to get signed by them, but they, you know, they just wanted to freelance with me. And then at some point I'd been submitted by a different agency for a role in a Shakespeare thing downtown. And I got the part, and I got it over one of their actors, this agency that I liked. So they came to see the show because they had another actor in it too. And after that, they were like, okay, we'd like you to sign with us, and, you know, we want to work with you. So that was how I got representation. My first equity job was a regional theater job in Philadelphia at the Wilma Theater. doing the portrait of Dorian Gray. And so I was, you know, I was bit by bit kind of taking steps that I, of course, thought were taking forever. In hindsight, it was, you know, most of this happened in the span of 2 or 3 years, really. I think I had my equity card within in under 2 years. And I did my first really big to me thing. I mean, getting my equity card was a big deal. But I was doing a lot of regional theater based in New York, and I lived in 13 places my first 3 years in New York because I never didn't have the money for a lease anywhere. So I was house sitting or subletting or staying with friends or whatever.
Oh my God.
But that was just kind of like the way it was. I had a storage space that had all my stuff in it. And then whenever I needed it, I would go get that. It was great when I would get a job out of town because I was just like, all right, yeah. I don't have to worry about the lease. I'm just going. But I finally got hired as the understudy for Peter Gallagher in a play called Total Eclipse off Broadway. And he ended up leaving. And I, after a long, very involved series of events and auditions and them bringing other people in and trying to continue to rehearse with me just so the company could keep working while they found their replacement, and eventually realizing that that was getting weird because they were rehearsing with somebody that they were told was not going to be doing the part. So, and it's like one of the two main characters in the show. So after all this, finally, I ended up getting the part. And it was many ways miserable experience, except for the cast, and especially the other actor I worked with, who was an actor named Peter Evans, who was just a fantastic human and a wonderful actor, and the first person I knew personally to die of AIDS, which was, you know, really not, it didn't happen then, it happened some years later, so that was my first time my name was on a poster, which was a big deal for me. And then not too long after that, I got my first, I'd been getting like occasional lines on soap operas and stuff, as Doctor Number Four or whatever. And, I graduated from, you know, the Peach Pit, eating hamburgers. I got a role that actually shot for like a few days, and I was the best friend of the girl who got murdered in this miniseries called Double Take, I think it was called, with Richard Crenna. So that was cool. Like, you know, I had a little one room of a triple banger, you know, trailer. But my
I
name
made it.
My name was on it for the day, you know.
Did you think at that point that you were like, I'm a made man? Or where did you have the wherewithal to be like, I know I'm still got a long ways to go?
I knew it was a long ways to go, and I wasn't convinced that this was, I was really primarily only interested in theater. I wasn't really looking for a career in television and film. And the Total Eclipse was nicknamed Total Collapse. We closed like a week or two after we opened. It was not well received. I remember
theater can be so heartbreaking because you spend so much time on it before it opens.
You get committed to the other people, and if a movie or TV show flops, you're not around when it happens. Like
done it. It's done.
So that was, you know, that was a hard lesson early on, and I got some of my early worst reviews of my career.
Get them out of the way at the beginning of the career.
Yeah, I remember Frank Rich said, he was one of the more generous ones. He said, it's even possible that Michael Cerveris, a young actor unknown to me, is better than he appears to be here. It's like, well, you know, all things considered, that was not so bad. So in theater, you know, I'd gotten to that point, but given the reception, I wasn't at all sure. I didn't feel like, okay, now I've made it. It was like, that might have been the end right there.
Right.
And the TV thing was, it was a fun experience, but like I said, it wasn't something that I necessarily thought was going to happen for me.
Yeah.
And New York, there were several shows and things filming here, but LA was really so much more where things were happening.
Right.
And so then it wasn't too long after that, I guess, I had an audition for the TV series Fame. And that was when, that was the first thing that, so I ended up getting the part and had to move to LA. And I really debated whether I should take it or not. Because
of the move part of it?
Because of the move part of it, because of, you know, Hollywood, which in my mind was just, you know, a cesspool and, you know, of really crappy stuff. And you know,
I went to Yale. Hollywood exactly. is not for me.
Exactly. Well, it's funny because I would go into these auditions all the time. This actually relates to how I got the job, because I would go into these auditions for, you know, Street Thug number 5. But I would go into the auditions and the, you know, the chatting part at the beginning where they ask like where you went to school or just a couple things about you. And I would tell them I went to Yale. And then I think in the audition itself, I would hopefully be convincingly thuggish, but you know, but they knew that I was this Yale actor guy. I mean, maybe I was fooling myself and I wasn't really giving as good an audition as I thought, but I started to get the feeling that I was doing myself a disservice by, you know, by letting them know who I actually was beforehand, because especially in TV right. and film, it felt like they have no creativity. They just, if you are it walking in, they believe it. If you even, no matter how convincing you are in the reading part, if they know that that's not you, they somehow don't trust that, you know, your whole job is to do this over and over again and convince people all the time. So when I went in for the audition for Fame, I went in and did because it was playing a British rock and roll student. So I did what I'm sure was a fairly lame British accent, but you know, it was my best Artful Dodger Spinal Tap thing. But I did it the whole time, and I did it with the receptionist.
When you walked into the room,
with the receptionist outside
nice.
The room, and then in the room itself, and I answered the questions accurately, you know, about my name and where I was from and all the rest. I just was doing it with a British accent the whole time. And also I think critically I brought my guitar in cause they wanted you to sing something. And I brought my guitar in and played and accompany myself on a David Bowie song. Cause I figured, I'm not going to do a show tune to play a rock right. and roll guy. And I don't know, you know, how much that helped, but I think it removed a level of confusion for them where they could just kind of buy it from the beginning. And
That's smart. Know, that's really, really smart.
That's savvy they don't teach you.
But the hustle part of it is you had learned your lesson earlier and you thought, how do I curb this issue where they're going to ask me about myself? It's this kind of role. I say Yale. That puts a certain thing in their mind. How do I cut all that shit out?
Yeah.
And just walk in as the thing.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is they weren't wrong.
It would have been great, though, if they said, thank you so much, Michael, and you cut the accent and were like, thanks so much. Bye. And they were like, wait, what?
Thanks, y'all. I'll see you later.
He's brilliant.
But the thing was, they weren't wrong. I did have a chip on my shoulder about, you know, movies and TV. And I did have an attitude about, you know, I'm a New York theater actor. And so when I got the job, I really considered turning it down because I thought, you know, I don't want to go out there and sell my soul to Hollywood.
The cesspool.
Yeah.
At the time too, it was so New York was theater. You know, now in New York, since like 2010, there's been an enormous television boom. And now it's not necessarily equal, but I mean, sometimes it sort of is. But it was very on-camera, West Coast theater.
Well, and also, you were either a theater actor or a screen actor. You were not both very often. Like, there's so much more, crossover now. I mean, there's almost really no sort of restrictions anymore, but it used to be really hard to be taken seriously by, oh shoot. Can you hold on 1 second? Can we just pause 1 second? There's somebody at the door. Hold on.
Delivery guy.
Nice. So yeah, in those days you're really, you know, there was a real, the film and TV casting people sort of had questions about whether you could work on screen if all you had done was theater, and you know, somewhat of a prejudice the other way, but not as much really.
How long was the gig of fame in LA?
I was hired with an open-ended contract. I was a series regular, but it ended up just being one season. It was the final season of it. And
could you not get back to New York quick enough when that gig was done?
Well, no, because I really enjoyed being out there. And I thought, you know, this time I thought this is my, you know, start in the movies. Despite my
Evie, come here, boo.
Despite my early, you know, reticence, I remember talking to my uncle who had been a screenwriter back in the 60s and had stayed out there in LA. And I remember telling him, you know, that I was concerned about selling my soul and going to LA. And he was like, well, what's, you know, it's all so very funny talking about this in the middle of the strike right now, where I realize I was right all along. But he said, you know, there's no virtue in being uncorruptible if you've never been tempted. So, you know, if you're the kind of guy who's going to sell out and do crappy TV stuff, you're not being honorable just avoiding it in the first place. You know, go out there and see if you can make a career that you can be proud of here too. And that seemed to, you know, make sense to me. So I went out and I really enjoyed it. But when it ended, because like I said, I didn't have a place to return to in New York. I had 13 places to return to. I just was like, okay, now I'm here. I guess I'll go back to doing what I was doing, which was regional theater. So I just started doing regional theater now based out of LA. So it was, you know, Seattle Rep and Old Globe and up and down the West Coast and occasional TV things here and there, but not really very much. It wasn't like that was another early lesson in it's not a one-way escalator to the top. It's like a ladder where you take one step up and four steps down and, you know, get on another ladder and, oh, this ladder goes sideways and, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a good thing to learn too. And also, like, your income is not now set at what your last pay rate was, you know.
Right.
So you can't keep spending assuming that you're always going to make the same amount of money, you know.
Right. This check from the Seattle theater is a little different than being a regular on Fame.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Evie. She's just so excited now.
So excited. She's still waiting for somebody to show up at the door, but it was just a delivery guy.
Did you have the moment where you realized like how easier it was to make money in television versus theater? Was
I had that. I had that right away.
Yeah, for sure.
But probably. I still really loved doing theater and really identified primarily as a theater actor. And when push comes to shove, I still feel that that's the truest thing about me, is, you know, that I'm a creature of the theater, even though I, you know, had been doing, I hadn't been on stage. I did a Christmas Carol in Pittsburgh this past Christmas.
Nice.
And it was a blast. But I realized I hadn't acted on stage in 6 years, which I don't think has been true since I was like
Fun Home
11.
The last?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
And that was just kind of mind blowing to think that all my work has been on film and television since then. Which I've really enjoyed, and you know, the schedule of theater is so demanding and so relentless. And I have been so fortunate to work steadily in theater, so that, and sometimes like overlapping shows. So you're rehearsing one, doing another at night. You know, I was so lucky that that was the case, but it was fucking exhausting, and my life was 8 shows a week and 1 day a week off for years at a time. And then discovering, you know, being reminded that I could make the same amount of money doing 2 days work in one episode of a TV show as I would make in a whole month of starring above the title in a Broadway show. You know, it kind of put some things in perspective.
Did that just kind of piss you off, though, too?
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an indication of how out of whack. And it's not just in our business; it's in every business. You know, I mean, in the, you know, these arguments about what executives are paid versus what workers are paid in our industry and in every industry are really valid ones. It's like, people are not compensated according to the work necessarily. And, you know, in acting, you're paid for your time waiting and paid for your time sacrificing and your time between jobs. You know, you don't punch a clock. If you have 2 scenes in a Broadway show, you can be paid the same as people who have or in every scene, you know. And and if you're a principal, I know for a fact that I have not worked as hard as ensemble members in the same show, just from a physical, technical standpoint. And yet,
it takes a lot of athleticism to do all that.
Yeah. I mean,
we've had a lot of guests on who are ensemble or leads in, you know, big Broadway musicals, and it is physically taxing. Well, to do it every single day. I mean, it's a lot.
They did a study. I remember when I was doing, I can't remember which show, but they were doing a study, I think trying to see if there was an effect of all the haze, whether it was healthy to be breathing all that in. And they had actors like, you would come off stage and breathe into a little, you know, collection gathering thing that would like analyze the amount of haze stuff that was in your lungs when you came off stage. And so they're doing all these things, checking actors to try to figure that out. And I remember one of the reports coming back and saying, essentially, when you do a Broadway show, it's like going through a car crash 8 times a week. In terms of like the adrenaline hit to your system and the physical demands on your joints and your back and your feet and everything. And that sounded about right, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah,
exactly.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
So, Michael, you made your Broadway debut in Tommy. How did that come about, and what was that, I suppose, the getting in the door and audition process and all of that, like, for your Broadway debut?
Well, I was continuing, like I'd said, to just do regional theater. And at the time the auditions came about, I was doing, I was playing a supporting role in Richard II at the Mark Taper Forum in downtown LA. And I remember really clearly getting this audition and going on a lunch break over into the Valley to audition for Tommy, you know, for the, somebody's making a Broadway musical version of Tommy. Sounds
they were
like
doing auditions in the Valley.
Yeah. There was some like rehearsal space over in the Valley where they were doing the auditions for some reason. And so I drove over, and once again, they wanted you to come in, bring a, you know, a pop or rock song. And there was no script or anything. I didn't even know what role I was auditioning for. I don't think I necessarily even was told that. So I just came in and I brought my same song that I had, Young Americans, the David Bowie song that I'd used for my Fame audition. I figured, well, worked once. So I went over and did that. And, you know, but it was like, how are they going to make a Broadway musical of Tommy? And, you know, I really didn't think a lot about it. It wasn't like, oh my God, I've got to get in this. And, you know, it's going to be amazing.
You weren't really putting your eggs in that basket per se.
No. And the general sort of talk around town was like, and it was at that point, it was just at La Jolla Playhouse. So it was a regional theater thing. You know, they had hopes and expectations that it would go to Broadway, but everybody does. So it wasn't like people were going, oh, this is the thing to get. It was kind of like, that may be a shit show, but, you know, hey, might as well audition. So I did that. And then I went back to my, you know, classical drama, and then got called back for a dance call, which is, you know, a toss up between, you know, getting hit in the face with a shovel or doing a dance call. Like, I... not sure which I would choose, honestly. But it was great because Wayne Cilento, the choreographer, had everybody from every different part would get called into groups together. So it wasn't just like me and a bunch of dancers. It was me and a bunch of other actors who kind of move if we absolutely have to, and some dancers. So there's always somebody else in the room who is at least as lame as you were to make you feel better about yourself.
I'm thinking of your musical theater credits, and I'm like, yeah, these aren't really like, Michael's doesn't do the dance.
No,
kind of.
I'm like a 2 1/4 threat at most,
right?
You know, and it's funny because in Tommy, like, I was in musical numbers and stuff, but, and people think that I danced, but I'm like, no, I would like go like that. And then a bunch of dancers would actually dance. And in your memory, you think of it as I was dancing too, but I was not really dancing any more than, you know, then like Madonna and a lot of front people will kind of like learn enough of the choreo to kind of right. Get it started. And then everybody else goes flying around all over and you kind of just walk around and sing. But everybody thinks you're this amazing dancer. I mean, Madonna may be a fantastic dancer. I don't really recall. But so there was that. And then I think there was one more callback. And then there was a long wait because they then went to New York and did a whole round of auditions there and stuff. And then I got the call that I had the job, and I still don't even know. I think I assumed I was up for like Cousin Kevin or something, because I figured Tommy was going to have long, blonde, curly hair like Roger Daltrey. And then I found out that I was playing Tommy, but there still was no script. So, and I was, you know,
really was this to do it out of town in La Jolla?
Yeah, this was to do it in La
okay,
Jolla.
Okay.
Yeah, the very first production of it. And
that's so, pretty cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. And so I went and rented the movie at Blockbuster, because there was such a thing still. And
I miss Blockbuster.
Don't you? Just like wandering in.
Well, also you just spend so much time deciding what the hell you'd pick that you're like, okay, well now we've been in here for 45 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, just get something.
Right. Yeah. And now we scroll on our TVs for 45 minutes. What the fuck do I watch tonight?
That's true.
Have same thing, just different.
Do you ever go to the Alamo Drafthouse movie theater in New York?
Yeah. It's awesome.
Do you go to the one down in the financial district?
I haven't been to that one. I used to live in Brooklyn and it was my I was a regular there.
Yeah.
My favorite.
The one in the financial district has the do you remember Kim's Underground?
The video store.
Yeah. It exists still in the lobby of the Alamo Draft House, and they have DVDs and I think even some VHS tapes.
Yep.
And you can rent them down there, and they have all the weird things that you can only find, you know, there that aren't available on streaming and stuff. I love going
early
down there
Cronenberg films and
totally.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, love Alamo Draft House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I rented Tommy and I watched it and I was like, well, this is not helping me at all because Roger Daltrey only sings like two songs on camera at the end. The rest of it's all kind of like voiceover narration. And
you don't have a script, so you're just like, I have no fucking idea what on earth I've even I'm about to do.
Yeah, Tommy says nothing. I think maybe even the whole movie, or maybe he says a couple lines at the end, but it's just mostly this kind of like floppy meat puppet that they carry around all the time. So I'm like, I have no idea what this job is, but I definitely want to do it. So for a while, I was doing double duty rehearsing in La Jolla during the day and doing the show at the Taper at night. And that's with like a, you know, depending on the traffic.
That's a really far. La Jolla, if you don't know, guys, is San Diego, basically.
And
between San Diego County and LA County is the entirety of Orange County. Yeah. And that, holy shit, you were doing back to back?
Yeah, I would usually, I would stay, let's see, what would I do? Yeah, I think normally I would do the show and I would drive back at night because there was less traffic. So it'd be there.
The sun's out, forget it.
Yeah. So I'd be there.
Or if it rains, people in Southern California just like
have never seen rain before. And, you know,
I'm from Orange County, so I know LA and San Diego. Water falls from the sky and they just lose all memory of how to make a car move forward. God.
Exactly.
So you did the La Jolla production. How far after did the transfer to New York happen?
Well, we kept extending and extending in La Jolla, and it became this huge hit there. And it was funny because we knew we were making something really cool and that we were really proud of and that audiences really took to. We had to cancel our first preview or two though because it was so technically complicated. We didn't finish tech. Yeah. And the first time we actually got through the whole show was the first preview audience. But we got to listening to, and so all we were doing was trying not to get killed by moving scenery.
Right.
And we got to listening to you, and the audience literally leapt to their feet in the middle of the song. And that was the first indication that we even had that there was an audience because we were so focused on just getting through it. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it was just kind of like this steamroller. And so the talk of transferring it got, you know, greater and greater. And, but we closed and there was no clear plan for it yet. And we were all told, you know, we'll be in touch. And I stayed in La Jolla and did another play. I did a Shakespeare play. I did Much Ado About Nothing there.
Always back to the bard with you, huh?
Exactly. That's kind of been my thing. Like if I do one thing, I don't follow it up with the next logical step in that direction. I turn my back on it and go a different direction almost immediately. And so I stayed and did that. And then then it was decided that it was going to go to Broadway and that we all had to re-audition for our parts. So most everybody else who, there were some people who had come from New York to do it originally, and all the people who lived in LA went to auditions out there, and then they were going to have auditions in New York. And so they flew me out to New York to do the final callbacks with the other Tommies. And it was right, it was like January 4th or something, right after the first of the year. It was the first weekend after New Year's. So that the airport was packed with people, and they had bought me a ticket. They flew me out there. And I was bringing my guitar because I was going to, you know, redo my audition that had gotten me the part in the first place. And so I go to check in at the airport, and I had a cold around Christmas time, and I was still like kind of recovering from it. So I'm not feeling super great. And I get to the airport and they're checking me in, and they said, so your bags are going to go through to San Juan. And I'm like, San Juan? They're like, yeah, your tickets to San Juan through via New York. And I was like, no, I'm getting off in New York. And they said, well, you can get off, but your bags are going to San Juan. I was like, well, no, that's not going to work. And so frenzied phone calls on a Sunday later, it turns out that they had bought me this cheap ticket thinking, because for some reason it was cheaper to fly to San Juan from LA via New York than LA to New York. But they hadn't told me that. And so I was like, well, I can't do this because I've got my guitar and stuff. I can't do it. So they had me get off that flight, book myself on another flight. They said, we'll pay you back. But now I'm like, you know, all the flights are packed. I have to wait in the airport for hours. I don't get in until late at night.
You're kind of sick.
The audition's the next day. And I warm up in the music director's apartment, and he has cats, and I'm allergic to cats, but I didn't know that he had cats. And so I get to the audition, and I decide I'm going to sing two songs in addition to the stuff that they asked me to sing. I'm going to sing Young Americans and Psychedelic Furs, Pretty in Pink, because I'm just going to leave no question who they need to hire for this part, despite the fact that I've done it 110 times by this point in front of the same people who are going to judge it this time. Producers and all. But so I do that, and I get through the two songs okay, and then I start to sing the Tommy stuff, and my voice just dries up and goes away. And the thing that I've been worried about since closing night is actually happening. But it's so, like, there's nothing I can do. And Des keeps me there and has me do the, you know, read the four lines of dialogue, I think just to not like give up on the whole thing. And, you know, that was kind of a great lesson too, because I was there having my worst fears realized. And yet, you know, I could hear the subway rumbling, you know, streets below, and like the clock was still moving. Like, you know, I wanted the earth to open up and swallow me, but it didn't. And, you know, I was going to survive anyway. And they kept me around for a few days, I think, debating whether they would try to have me come back in again and see if I was feeling any better, but it wasn't going to change that much. And then I get invited to this dinner with Des and Pete Townsend. And I'm thinking, well, here's the consolation dinner thing. And so we're, you know, having a nice dinner. And then Pete starts talking about flying me over to London and to hang out, and he wants to show me around like the neighborhoods that he grew up in and introduce me to his friends from, you know, back in the day. And I'm thinking, well, this is turning into a pretty good consolation prize thing. And then he says, I just think it's fucking great that we saw thousands of people for this part, and the one who gave the absolute most ridiculous rubbish audition is the guy that we're gonna hire.
Holy shit.
That was my first clue that that I had the job. And
3 pounds told. Oh my God. Yeah. That,
and
that,
and he did, and he brought me over, and
that's like, probably, you know, Tommy, my co-host and I usually, we love the stories when you get the call for Broadway, yeah. And they're always, you know, like there's just something about that. It's different than like on camera stuff, I think,
yeah.
Because Broadway as an institution is just such a behemoth of like a goal. It's just different. And those stories, they're always like, we love them. But I have to say, I think hearing it from fucking Pete Townsend takes the cake in terms of that story of getting the news that you're going to be on Broadway. Yeah. Holy cow.
Especially in that context too.
Yeah.
You're like, I thought we were like friends. Oh, we're like working. I'm getting the job. I thought we were just hanging out.
Yeah. I was convinced that it was all over, you know?
Wow.
It's funny then. Then a while after that, I had on my answering machine for a while when you called, had the "Who are you?" You know, it was my outgoing message. And Pete called one time my house, and he said, "I'm fucking Pete Townsend. Who the fuck are you? Who am I?"
Oh my God, that's awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's a really wow. So,
and as you know, and as a rock and roll kid, like those things were a bigger deal to me almost
totally.
Than having my Broadway debut, you know?
Right.
And in the end, almost there were a handful of UCSD students who were in the production in La Jolla and a couple of other actors who didn't make the move to Broadway, but almost all of the original cast from La Jolla, did Broadway, and it was the Broadway debut of every single person in the show, which was pretty cool. And especially when you look back and it's like people like Norm Lewis and Alice Ripley and Sherry Renee Scott and Michael McElroy and like all these people.
Jeez Louise.
It was pretty cool.
Wow. That's amazing. And my God, after that, you know, the rest is history. Your Broadway credits are unbelievably. You have 2 Tonys out of it, and my goodness. Well, Michael, thank you so much for hanging out today and chatting with us. And normally, you know, at the end, we ask for people who are either just starting out in the business, i.e., you know, coming out of school or something like that, or for people who are feeling a little stuck. I know at the moment we're in a strike, and so a certain portion of the acting community is just stuck, but
it's not an illusion, you know, that we're stuck right now.
Yeah. But no, you know, if you're like feeling stuck in your career outside of that, the strike that's going on right now, what advice would you give to people who are, you know, just sort of starting this journey or might be, you know, a little stuck?
Well, a couple things. One is the thing that we talked about earlier about not comparing your progress to other people's progress. I think that serves you throughout your career. And the fact that it's not just a one-way progression. And then sort of 2 other things I've really discovered that are useful in that way. One is that there was a time when I was out in LA and I'd always, you know, played music like I was saying, but I had such an idea of who got to call themselves musicians because of the example of my father, who was devoted to it. And I felt like I was kind of a fake because I didn't read music and I hadn't spent years learning theory and stuff. But at a certain point in LA, where you kind of are what you pretend to be, basically. And I would be hanging out when I was doing Fame. I would go out to clubs and see bands and stuff. And I would meet people because they thought I was this British rock and roll guy. I didn't do the accent when I went out to see shows. But so I would meet people and realize, you know, they had like 5 record deals. And it was like, I'm not better than them, but I'm not really worse than them as a guitar player. So I finally got out of my own way and started having a creative pursuit of my own that wasn't dependent on being hired by other people.
Yes.
I can, you know, stay at home and play guitar and write music all day. And having that through the strike now and through other, you know, slow times has been so valuable that I can still feel creative and not dependent on other people. And for a while, I would be part of groups of other actors who would just get together and read plays for no reason other than to get together and keep your muscles going and to, you know, and to hear new plays and stuff. So that kind of thing, whether it's, you know, gardening or you know, woodworking or, you know, whatever makes you, gives you pleasure and helps you feel creative, it's really helpful to have that so that you're not just waiting for someone to give you a chance to use that part of you. And then the other thing was, like we have been saying, I wasn't one of those people who like watched the Tonys and said, I'm going to be there one day. I kind of didn't think it had much to do with me when I was a kid watching them because I thought I wanted to be a Shakespearean actor. And if you weren't British and didn't do musicals, you didn't end up on the Tonys, I thought. So, I learned more to kind of, and actually I learned this a lot from Tom Hulse, who I did a play with in Seattle years ago. And he talked about not really looking at an end goal, more looking at a progression goal and, you know, I'm wanting to be better tomorrow than you are today and wanting to know more next week than you know this week. And setting, you know, small attainable goals as steps along the way and putting your focus and energy in that, which A, helps you appreciate what you're doing now instead of just looking at the distance between where you are and where you think you want to be. Because half the time when you get there, you're like, oh, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really served me well over the years too. And it's helped me to be, to value my experience in the moment and not worry about where it was going to get me. And it's, I think, led to a lot of the ways I've made decisions about career choices and stuff. My career choices have very often not been the logical next step and not been the traditional thing that you would do. I mean, after I made my Broadway debut, I not only like left the show and left town, I left the country and went to do Tommy in Germany, in the first European company in Germany, and stayed there for 2 years in the end.
Whoa.
Which is like ridiculous to make your Broadway debut in a really successful show and, you know, Tony nomination, and then just not be in New York or the country for 2 years. But I got to live in Germany and I got to be paid better than I was on Broadway with no expenses and explore the world for a while. And I took full advantage of it and traveled a bunch and had all kinds of amazing experiences I never would have had. And then I came back and had the money to be able, in those days, this was possible for normal humans, to buy an apartment, you know, and that accidental financial decision has made it possible for me to do a lot of jobs that I couldn't have afforded to do if I didn't, you know, have my own place.
Yeah.
And when Hedwig came around, I had lived in Germany. I knew, you know, some German. I had a pretty credible German accent, and I had a sense of all of Hedwig's background. And so it turned out to have been a great, research project living there. So you never know like what thing you're interested in or that what skill you might acquire may bizarrely come in handy later. I mean, playing guitar turned out to be really handy when John Doyle wanted actor musicians for Sweeney Todd. So, you know, following what excites you and interests you rather than what you think is going to be the smart career choice, I think is a much more likely to bring you satisfaction and happiness and ultimately sometimes lead you to having the skills that you never would have imagined you would ever use, but turned out to be exactly the thing that get you the job or make you able to really do something, you know, interesting and good down the line. You know, and if it doesn't, you still are spending your time investing it in something that you care about. So yeah, that's the main thing. Just only do stuff you care about, because the rest, there's no formula, there's no guarantee. If you're doing things you care about, you're so much closer to being satisfied with what you're doing, what your career is, I think.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. You're welcome. This was such a fantastic chat. Congratulations on, you know, all that you've done and accomplished. And
thanks.
I think it is, you have so much more, obviously. You know, you have such an incredible career, and we know there's just going to be so much more of it. So
I certainly hope so. There are times, yeah, you know,
yes,
that's the other thing, man. I mean, I look back and I am very proud of so many things that I've done and been a part of. I still have that feeling of, did I peak? Is it all kind of behind me now? You know, and I still have that thing of every time a job ends, it's like, and that's the end of my career. Yeah, so, wow. You know, I
think, that's a wrap on Michael. And you're like, is it actually though?
Actually. Yeah. And, you know, and at the moment, I think it's even harder to fight that feeling.
Yeah.
But that's also, you just have to kind of embrace that as part of what the career in the arts is, you know?
Yeah.
Do you exist now and today and throughout as you move forward with pride in your heart for yourself?
Yeah, I have to sometimes remind myself of that, because it's easy to kind of go, wow, man, the phone hasn't been ringing like it used to. And in many ways, I see the business, especially in commercial theater and commercial things, moving into other directions. Part of it's just aging in the business. You know, you start to feel increasingly irrelevant as you go along, because there's always such an emphasis on young people and new things and stuff. So there's a natural kind of temptation to feel more and more like a dinosaur, and more like people aren't really interested in what I have to offer anymore. So I have to fight that feeling. But when I do kind of encounter memories or photographs, or somebody asks me about things that I've done, I am really proud of what I have done. And, you know, and if that turns out to be it, I have nothing to complain about. I mean, I'm grateful for all of it. I sure hope it's not. I feel like I have a lot more to offer, but you know, yeah,
I think that's true.
Who knows, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Michael, where can people find you online if they want to follow you on Instagram or anything?
I have Instagram is at Michael Cerveris, and Facebook, I think, is the same. And then my band, Loose Cattle, which is where a lot of my energy has been going lately. We have another record that's finished and we're hoping to put out by the end of the year, ideally.
Awesome.
They're called Loose Cattle, and we have like at Loose Cattle Band. If you just search for Loose Cattle, you often get videos of cattle that are loose, which is a perfectly
so
good.
So follow it up with band, yeah, just so Google knows what to, awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much again for joining us. This was fantastic.
You guys too. I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to meet you, man.
Bye. Yeah. You too.
Bye.
Thank you. Wow.
What a guy.
So cool. It's so funny. I was just thinking, like, in one of those last pieces of advice he had, you know, about not necessarily having like a huge goal in front of you, but just sort of like, so much of this industry is not up to you. So sometimes it's like counterproductive to, you know, have these enormous goals that it's not, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And then all these things in his life that I wouldn't necessarily say are like happy accidents, but, you know, his dad being like, let's learn an instrument, and that serving him way down the line, or taking a side step to Germany, and how that would, you know, it's like all these little things that in other parts of his life and career became so useful.
Yeah. It seems too like that he just had such a settled in approach to everything he was doing. He never romanticized what he was doing in any way. Like I have made the mistake of doing so often, you know? And I think like the environment that you keep when you're a kid and the habits that you develop, they really translate to how you then take on whatever it is that you go into pursue. And yeah, he's just, and I think that's so attractive to people when they see that, because, you know, being like needy and desperate is so transparent. You can see right through that kind of behavior. And it's no surprise that he has been as successful as he has, just because, you know, he has such a calming presence that seems like, you know, I would love to do this, and I can prove to you that I can, but I also like am totally fine if it's not me. And you know, other people like myself, it's just like, let it be me, please let it be me. It's just like, it's definitely,
or when he was like, I got this offer and I didn't even know if I wanted to take it, you know?
Yeah it's just like I always
do. I move to LA and do a TV show.
Yeah
you know,
it's I admire people like that. And also, like, you know, he's got so much experience in this industry. Like, he looks like he's our age, you know?
Yeah.
but he's been doing this for a long time, and it shows. It's really cool to be able to chat with people like him, man. And honestly, just to be part of this thing, thanks, man. Like, I had such a blast, you know, just being able to
be a
guest co-host on the show and be a part of that conversation. It's so cool to just like get free insight from people like him, you know? It's such a rewarding experience to get to have those types of talks. And
yeah, there's so many episodes Tommy and I, when it's done, we're like, I needed that today.
Absolutely, man. I think we needed it all the time. And I think especially, you know, just, I don't know, living out in New York, living in industry towns, we get so caught up in like our business and what we're trying to get done and how we're going to do it, that we forget to like sit down and have a talk with people, with humans, you know? And especially like sometimes when they're like industry people, we're like, you know, how like, I don't want to talk about the industry because like, we want to just like sit and relax. But this platform really gives that entrance into doing that. And man, Michael was just such a perfect introduction to this show and to me and to being just like all well-rounded. It came full circle, and it was just, I did need that. You know, it's so nice, man, to just know that, you know, you just keep pushing forward. You just keep going. It was great.
Yep. Alrighty, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. You can find out more about Before the Break and how to become a working actor at workingactorpro.com. Follow us on Instagram at Before the Break Pod and Working Actor Pro. Follow us on Twitter at Before4, The Break Pod. Follow us on TikTok at Before the Break Pod. Check out my stuff at adamdecarlo.com and follow me at @AdamDeCarlo. You can check out Tom's stuff at that on thetomdowning.com and follow him at I'm Tommy. By the way, follow Julian at Julian Gavilanes. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a rating, and write a review if you like what you hear. Check back next week for an all new episode with an all new guest. I am not used to saying all that. That's usually Tommy's gig, but alrighty, we'll see you next time.
Take care.
You've been listening to Before the Break. The hosts are Tommy Beardmore and Adam DeCarlo. Cover art by Amanda June Boucher. Music by Benjamin Sturley. Before the Break is recorded live from Los Angeles and New York City.